Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for June's Small Animal Practice Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce our speaker for today, RCVS Specialist in Feline Medicine, Danielle Gunn-Moore. Thank you, Danielle. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thank you, Sammy Jo. Lovely to be here, as always. I'm always very happy to give webinars for Sammy Jo. This is a great platform that she's got working here, which is good. So hopefully this is going to be useful to you. Certainly I know I get sent a lot of cases like the little cat I'm going to talk about now, and I get a lot of advice calls about them as well. So I know they're out there. Is everybody happy? Can everyone hear me? Just scribble in if there's any problems. If not, then I will, yep, that's all going well, perfect. I'm going to start actually with a little question. Isn't this picture beautiful? I found it on the web, but there's no credit to give. If anyone knows who painted it, I'd love to buy a copy for my wall, let alone anything else. Gorgeous. So we're going to be talking about behavioural problems in elderly cats. And you all know me, I do like to build this around a cat. Just going to make it bigger. There you go. Okay, I'm also going to be a little bit self-indulgent, and I'm going to put in pictures of my own babies across the top, or where I can. And so you can see this was little Tia Ninnick when she was 18. She was a Bengal, but you can see she's got pretty tatty by then. So why is this important? Well, we know that cats are living to be ever older. And I saw some interesting data in Vet Times last week, which says there are now over 11 million pet cats in Britain. And given that, you know, at least a third or so are going to be older, then it's not only good for cats that we really try to care for these, but actually it's really good medicine and it's very good for practice income. So that's a win-win, isn't it? And I just popped this in. So these are the international cat care kind of guidelines of what ages cats are. So we're really talking about seniors, so that's from 11 to 14 years, or what I've always called geriatric, 15 years plus. They're now calling them super senior because some people were offended at the thought of calling their cats geriatric. I don't know about you, but actually I would love some input from you. Because while I think it's okay to call them geriatric, maybe you don't. And if you don't, let me know, because I'm more than happy to switch over. And I think what is important, though, is that while we can use these age brackets as guidelines, they are only guidelines. All cats age differently. You know, my two cats, I've got Mortlach. He is a beautiful 16-year-old Maine Coon. But being a Maine Coon, of course, he's got horrible hips, horrible heart, horrible everything else. And he walks around really badly crippled and lives on just about as many drugs as I do to keep my back sorted. Well, his little Sheba kitten, she's the same age. And yes, she's got pretty bad kidney disease, but she jumps around and you'd seriously think she was half his age. So every cat ages at a different rate, but these are guidelines. So obviously you've got multiple physiological changes plus concurrent pathological changes. Changes occur in every piece of the cat, and you can see here that little Nessie, she used to be a chocolate tabby point Burman, well she still is in this photograph, but you can see her legs have faded so badly that they've barely got colour on them anymore. And my little black cat, little Sheba Ardbeg, she's got lots of grey ticking through her coat now, which never used to be there. But what we're really going to concentrate for this webinar, we're going to be talking about the brain and the skeleton in particular, but don't forget all these other systems as well. So we're going to talk about Sally. This is Sally when I first met her. She was 16. And her owners described her as having aged badly in the last 2 years. Until then, really, she seemed just the same as she'd always been. You can see she stopped grooming. In fact, she lives with a Labrador. And the Labrador is basically her staff and washes her face for her every morning. And this is Sally after she stayed over with us. And hence, she's got a grubby face. She's actually looking at me as if to say, come on, wash my face. I need someone to do this for me. Along with not grooming, which isn't causing her owner's too much of a problem. She has been peeing around the house and crying loudly at night. And their description is, hold your ears, that kind of like between 3 and 4 in the morning, so middle of the night, suddenly you hear, and you wake up going, what on earth? And she just looks at you and goes, oh, hello, you're awake, mummy. And I can relate to this completely because I have had two of my cats go senile over the years, and it's pretty tough to live with. But interestingly, despite that, Sally's people didn't volunteer these as problems. Sally came in for a routine vaccination. It was only when our Dick Vet General Practice staff were asking more questions that they thought, hang on, this little cat might be showing signs of dementia. And they asked if they'd like to come and see me. And that's how I met her. On my physical findings, you can see she's a bit skinny. She was a bit dehydrated. She's got a pretty fast heart rate. And there is a gallop sign. Okay, so I can hear a gallop. And that's never benign, okay? There is no benign reason. Yes, it could be anemia, it could be hypothyroidism, but something's wrong with that heart. The heart muscle is definitely under trouble. The left thyroid gland felt a little big to me, and you're looking at her photo. You've already assessed how bad her arthritis is, haven't you? Absolutely. You can see that she's got a ruched back. The angle she's holding her tail at is all wrong. Her knees, actually, her stifles actually look thickened. You can't see her elbows sticking out quite so much, but they're pretty thickened too. And if you had a video of her, it would be even more obvious. But the point is that you can see how bad her arthritis is from a still photograph. And that shows you how easy it is to actually spot. You just need to look. And the owners, once they were asked about potential signs of dementia, they volunteered them. But they won't volunteer them without being asked because owners think, well, it's just aging, isn't it? They worry, well, two major things. They worry, one, that we won't be able to do anything to help their cat. More importantly, yeah, you've guessed, they actually worry that we'll suggest that the cat should be euthanized. So we really got to have this conversation with owners so they find out we really want to help make their elderly cats have the best quality of life as possible. So problem list for this little girl, we've got the inappropriate urination. I put all the cardiac things together, rightly or wrongly. I put the altered behaviour and the night crying together. Then we've got the mild dehydration and the arthritis. So the major problems for differentials for each of the problems. The inappropriate urination, it's a common problem in cats of all ages, but in elderly cats, it's going to have a slightly different profile. So we could be looking at true behavioural problems or brain problems. So yeah, we could be dealing with cognitive dysfunction, but don't forget about something like a slow-growing meningioma. By way of problems actually affecting the bladder, so there we've got feline lower urinary tract disease, that's the umbrella term. And you can see if you look at this graph, the kind of lilac colour is for cats less than 10, which would be the majority of cats you see showing signs of cystitis. And you can see the vast majority are stress cystitis, idiopathic cystitis, or plugs, which are the same thing. But when we're looking at our older cats, which are kind of the mauve, what colour is that? Burgundy, the majority are urinary tract infections. Now, clearly, you don't just hit your 10th birthday and suddenly get a urinary tract infection. Why are we seeing those? Well, we're seeing those because there are underlying problems that are causing PUPD. So chronic kidney disease, hyperthyroidism, and diabetes mellitus. All of these cause the urine to be less concentrated than it was before, which means it's going to be a bigger risk of bacteria ascending. But also, they all cause systemic immunosuppression. So circulating uremic toxins, thyroxine in itself, or blood glucose, all get into the circulation and make the neutrophils go, I'm an unhappy neutrophil. And an unhappy neutrophil is not going to be able to fight the infections properly. So it really puts these cats at risk of a UTI. And obviously, with a cat with diabetes, you've added a whole load of glucose to the pee to make it a perfect medium for growing bugs. So we definitely need to be thinking about that. And then we mustn't forget the musculoskeletal problems. And these cats are so prone to osteoarthritis. Now, clearly the little cat on the loo there isn't having a problem, but he might as he gets older. Then if we look at the cardiac problems, so remember I said that that gallop is never going to be benign, so we do need to consider this. And what do you think? Do you think primary cardiac disease or secondary in a 14-year-old cat? Yeah, I can hear, I can kind of in my mind hear you going, secondary, I think. Absolutely. Primary cardiac disease has usually killed most cats before they got to the age of 14. So it's likely to be secondary to hypothyroidism, hypertension, chronic kidney disease, diabetes, hypersomatotropism, or ultimately that becomes acromegaly. So we're seeing quite a lot of the same diseases coming up here again and again. And then for her altered behaviour, I must admit, whenever I have a case where I've got altered behaviour, inappropriate urination, you know, behavioural signs in elderly cats, I cross my fingers and go, oh, hypertension, hypertension, give it hypertension, because that's my most treatable. And it can be primary. More typically, we do find it's secondary to hypothyroidism, which very, very treatable. Chronic kidney disease, diabetes mellitus. I'm going to add in hyperaldosteronism, which I think I should write that in because we are diagnosing that more and more frequently now. Of the degenerative conditions, then obviously cognitive dysfunction is a major one, and that can be caused from long-term vascular problems. But don't forget about loss of hearing, because same way as elderly people, when they can't hear, well, you've got the same thing with elderly cats, such that, you know, they don't hear how loud they're shouting, so they shout louder. And if they can't smell their dinner, can't find their dinner, then they might be shouting for that. I've already mentioned meningioma as the most common neoplasia in cats of this age. Don't forget infections, particularly toxoplasmosis. I see quite a lot of elderly cats who've got toxo, and they present with geriatric behavioral problems. And that is because they caught toxo when they were hunting mice when they were kittens, or you know, 1 or 2 years old. And it's been dormant in their brain. Those little bradyzoites have been asleep. And then as the cat undergoes immune senescence, then those tachyzoites come back out again, and the cat starts getting inflammation within their brain. So please always look at their retina. If there are changes, then do consider hypertension or toxo being very common causes. And I've got urinary tract infection in there, which actually is really topical for all of you who are Archers listeners too. I love the Archers. They recently had a character, Auntie Caroline, I think it was, who was showing signs of dementia, and it turned out to be urinary tract infection. We see this in cats and dogs too. This is where it's usually an E. coli that is producing toxins. So the infection doesn't get out of the bladder, but the toxins do, and they can cause quite severe dementia. So to the point that a very good friend of mine, an elderly friend who had neoplasia, and he had a urinary catheter in. Despite that, when he went acute change of personality, he got sectioned. He got sectioned rather than they checked his urinary bag and thought about an infection. He was mortified once he started on the antibiotics, and I was mortified for him. You know, that should never have happened. So please, in cats, think about, and dogs, the potential that urinary tract infection could be the cause of signs of dementia. It is not an uncommon cause in people, and it's often missed. Then metabolic causes, the major one I'm going to touch on here really is hypothyroidism, because it can really drop your B vitamins to the point that even when you start treating the hypothyroidism, the B vitamins can have gone too low and the cat will still show signs of dementia. So if you're not sure, maybe, and I know we've lost Combivit, it used to be 1 mil of Combivit sorted them out because that had 35 mg of B1, ideally some B1 and some B12 as well, please. Don't forget arthritis. If you've been asleep and then you try to stand up, then you can certainly cry. And you don't know what position this little sally cat was sleeping in before she started to get up in the middle of the night, and maybe it was pain that makes her cry out at that time of the early morning. And then there are social and environmental causes, so attention-seeking behaviour, inter-cat conflict, all that sort of thing, which are all made very much worse by cognitive dysfunction problems. So I hope you can see from those last few slides, there are a lot of potential differentials we need to be thinking about for little Sally. So don't just jump in and go, I think I know what this is. Depending obviously on how much finance is available, etc. I really beg that you really think about these cats because so many of these conditions are very treatable. And you can really make the cats and their owners' quality of life much better. If we're looking at cognitive dysfunction, so I want to focus on for a few minutes. Yes, we know it's becoming ever more prevalent. Certainly by the time that humans get to about 85 years of age, depending on the studies and depending where you are in the world, but it's about 50% chance of dementia at that point. When we're looking at cats, then the behavioural problems we're looking at, loss of litter box training, like Sally's been showing, vocalisation, particularly at night, but be during the day as well, change in activity, altered interaction with their family. It's interesting, they usually become a lot more loving, to the point that with my little black cat, little Sheba Ardbeg, she won't let me shut the bathroom door when I go for a pee. And this morning she was dancing around the sink because she wanted a cuddle at the same time as I was trying to do my teeth, and she ended up with toothpaste on her tail and was most aggrieved. That can be a kind of fun side of things. Disorientation and changes in sleep cycles. And when we look at the prevalence, this was generated by my friend Kelly Moffat, nearly a third of cats are showing at least one geriatric onset behavioural problem by the time they're 11, and it's about 50% by the time they're 15. Just a little tiny bit of data about the dogs, or as you know, I call them the lesser species. Not surprisingly, they don't age as well. It's about a third of them showing dementia by 11, same, but it's about 70% are showing dementia by the time they're 15 plus. But of course, that's very breed dependent because bigger breeds tend to age quite poorly. Apparently, Bassets, sorry, beagles are supposed to get early onset dementia, but I do ask, how could you tell? I've never met a beagle that didn't appear to be a bit demented to start with. Is that bad? Shall I move on? I wanted to share this study with you. We haven't got it published yet, but we'll get there. This is over 2,000 questionnaires, first done in 1995 and then repeated 20 years later. It's all cats under the age of 12, so only in the UK, and it was interesting to see how few things had changed in that time frame. Over 50% showing polydipsia, about 60% don't want to go out as much, and that's interesting. Of course, it could be because they're shy, new cats in the environment, they don't feel they can defend themselves from as well. Maybe they simply can't get out of the cat flap now. Interestingly, more people, a lot more people, now 80% of people actually offer a litter box, which is great. People are beginning to realize old cats need a litter box, but still, about 30% are showing inappropriate elimination within the house. Interestingly, initially, 81% found to have increased affection, and that has fallen in the last survey, but I suspect that's because in 1995, maybe people didn't expect their cats to be so cuddly with them. Well, as so when the cats became that, they were really chuffed. Whereas nowadays, maybe they expect it. I'm not sure. What is important is 60% show increased vocalization, 30% that's at night, and that can put a massive strain onto the relationship between the cat and the owner and between the owners, because not always both owners are equally bonded to the cat. And just sleep anxiety, so sleep loss rather, is not good for cats, it's not good for people. What I do love though is in the first survey there was a question about whether or not the owners still love their cats as much. And 96% of owners, despite the fact that they were peeing all over the place, despite the fact they were waking them up at night, they loved them just as much, if not more, which is great, isn't it? So how do we diagnose cognitive dysfunction? Well, the presence of these clinical signs, and then exclude as many other causes as possible. And it's really due to a problem with getting the blood to the brain. So anything that prevents the blood flowing as well as it should to the brain. And then the the word is actually using the oxygen in that blood for energy. And you get a production of free radicals, and that gets worse as the mitochondria become less efficient with aging. And ultimately, you get shrinkage of the brain, amyloid deposition, and aging. And so it is quite similar to human Alzheimer's. So what we see, if we look into to the brains, you can see the panels on the left-hand side. These are from cat samples. These are where cat bodies have been very generously given to me at the end of the cat's life. You can see horrible plaques, which have got little holes in them where the nerves cells have died. And you also see these tangles where neurons can no longer function properly because they can't actually stretch out their axons to touch each other. So we have this pathway, oxidative damage. We don't really know exactly enough about that yet. There's a lot of work ongoing. And the neurons make this amyloid. Sorry, where that says AB, that should say A beta. And that generates plaques. That results in inflammation, and if you could tell when that was going to be, then obviously using an anti-inflammatory would be good. But the problem is that in humans it's going to be years, certainly before signs of dementia show up. But that causes hyperphosphorylation of tau. Tau is this protein that helps the microtubules in the neurons actually stretch out to meet each other, and ultimately get these tangles forming. So not a good scenario. So we also know all of these other changes occur. So you can see that the brain starts shrinking, and you get changes in the catecholamine neurotransmitters as well, such that all of the noradrenaline, adrenaline, serotonin, etc., all of these are lower than they should be, which is going to make brain function a lot more tricky. Cats and dogs do differ a little bit, and they differ a bit from humans, but they make naturally occurring models for the study of human disease, or the way I look at it, humans are a natural model for cat diseases. I know, I'm very, very biased. But anything that is found for humans that might help cats, that's great. Anything that's found in cats that might help humans, that's great too. So we're on a win-win here. And our pets live with us, they share our lifestyle, and so that means the lifestyle factors will have a role to play. So, can we learn from looking at Alzheimer's disease treatment what might be able to move across into our species? Well, we know environmental enrichment is good, that's the use it or lose it. We know that selegiline, that's a monoamine oxidase inhibitor. We know that can work in humans, and that's available to us. We're not using anything like Aricept in animals yet. Maybe that's next. Antioxidants, yes, definitely, but we don't know the right balance yet. The NSAIDs, obviously not going to use Brufen in cats, but that has been shown to help when given early. So basically, because I live on painkillers because of my back damage, the good thing is that you know what? I won't likely get dementia, which is good. I may well rot my gut, I may well trash my kidneys, and I'm definitely in a lot of pain, but at least I won't get dementia. So there's a silver lining to everything. The problem is we just don't know when you might use anti-inflammatories, as I say, for cats. What about dogs? Could we learn something from them? Well, this study I love. So this was a fancy diet with antioxidants and mitochondrial cofactors, etc., in it, and environmental enrichments. So they had a kennel mate, they had cognitive experience play, as it is, that sort of thing. And they were divided into four groups. One group of dogs got the good diet and the kennel mate and lots of friends, etc., lots of play. A group at the other end got the old food and no enrichment. And then the two groups in the middle were half and half. So either the environment or the diet. And what was able to be shown was when you then looked at it, you could they monitored these dogs, and then at end of life they did postmortems and looked in their brains. And if we look at these graphs, let me see if I can get a pointer up. No. There's a pointer. There we go. Pointer. Come on, pointer. There we go. Yeah, perfect. Gotcha. So this is amyloid load. These are just different areas of the brain. So the control environment is the red, and the green is the enriched environment. I hope you can see there's a lot more red here. So there was more amyloid in these dogs' brains. So the ones that were in the boring environment. But it wasn't quite statistically significant. But when we look at the antioxidant, you can see that the control dogs have got a lot more dementia. So this is Hills BD. It was Hills who did this study. So that shows you that actually diet change can make a significant difference to these dogs. You've got some drugs that are available. I've already mentioned selegiline. So that is marketed as Selegan. So I should have put selegiline up the top there. So that's this monoamine oxidase inhibitor. And certainly there are many, many studies. This is a very sensible, useful drug in humans. Sorry, I start again. It is used in humans, but in dogs. And vivitonin, there's a number of studies as well in this, in dogs and in humans, and it's got some positive effects. So there's two possibilities for the dogs. There are also a number of other things. You've got the DAP, of course, is now called Adaptil. That can certainly help reduce anxiety. There are a number of different products that could be considered. This one is rarely available, the nasergaline, so I didn't mention it. SAMI, Activate, Zenalife, a number of other combination products have been shown in double-blind placebo-controlled studies to reduce the signs of dementia in dogs. So that's great, isn't it? Well, what about cats then? Well, what we know is that, for one, drug studies, we'll get to that. Make me very cross that we have so few, but at least I'm working on that, and I do know some other people are trying to change that too. We know that whenever cats age, older cats, older animals don't cope well with with changes or anything that upsets them. And they really have a pretty limited way of dealing with that. They tend to lose their appetite, they tend to hide, altered behaviour, inappropriate urination, defecation. So here you see Cardu. He was my beautiful boy. He was the one who really started my interest in this. That was him at 10, but he did have kidney disease and high blood pressure. And this was him at 14, and he just hid the whole time and cried a lot at night. The dementia was really very upsetting. And it's really, really upsetting for owners to know what to do for the best. And they really worry that if it's the broken sleep that they feel is the worst part of it, they don't feel that they can suggest that euthanasia might be the best thing because they worry that you're going to think that they're giving up. And to be honest, they're willing to live with it. It amazes me. We were. So we really need to help these cats. So what can we do? Well, enrichment when young. Obviously, cats aren't great at Sudoku. All this one, though, that one up there is proving a good job. Feeding puzzles are really good. Feather play, feathers on sticks, etc. Make cats work for their dinner. Make cats be engaged. If they have access outside, perfect, but make sure it's safe. If they don't have access outside, well, could they have access into a run so they could watch the environment, get more enrichment that way? If you've only got one cat, and obviously some cats aren't terribly social, then that's all the more important that their environments are enriched, particularly if you're going out to work, so you need to have that discussion with owners. But once cognitive dysfunction starts, you're really stuck. You have got to make any changes that need to be made very gently, gradually, and with much reassurance. A lot of these cats feel less and less secure going out, so they need to have indoor litter boxes, etc. And they tend to shrink their environment with time. They don't want to go into the spare room. They don't want to go into the big room anymore. They just want to go to the wherever their litter box is, the kitchen and your bed. So you need to make sure that they have access to all of their key resources where they can get to it. So that's feeding stations, watering stations, litter box, resting places, preferably high up, but that they can get to it. Hiding places, either a secure hiding place where no one's going to pull them out and give them their drugs, or a way to exit. But say a lot of old cats, as you saw from the studies I've showed you, they really don't want to go out anymore. The companionship is as required. That is not considered an absolute key resource, although it is for some cats. So think about the resources. Here's little Cleo. She loves her little hidey box, hidey hole, and that's perfect. Little Hobie, he was 26, Sarah Caney's cat, and he liked to still go outside and stand on the patio, which is what he's doing there. But he didn't like to go out if Sarah didn't go out with him, because he was worried that other cats might be around, etc. So she stood, and that's her photograph of him. Then we've got Charlie at the top. Charlie's great because Charlie really loved to be in the kitchen of his people's house. But they got a puppy who kept bowling him over. So what they've done here, this is one of their kitchen cupboards, and they took the front door off, and he's got steps all the way up and round the room until they can get into the cupboard, and they've put a vet bed in there. And that's him just looking down on everybody in the kitchen. Happy boy. So think about their resources and make sure the owners understand that they've got to make those key resources easily available for their geriatric cats, and that they might need to shrink the environment so that with time the cats want less and less space. There are some diets that have been worked on. There is so the Nestle Purina Pro Plan 7 Plus. It wasn't designed for a geriatric diet, but in this study, which was a 5-year study, they did show that the supplemented cats lived significantly longer, which is great. And then the JD study, this has got a lot of different fabulous things in it. This is a 2-month study, a much shorter, but these were cats recruited at vaccination, that sort of thing. They weren't picked because the owners volunteered mobility problems or cognitive problems. And they found that over 50% had improved sign of mobility after they'd been on this diet, and over 70% had an improved cognition, which that is pretty good. I don't know what's in JD, but I've certainly had quite a lot of elderly cats that I've switched onto it that won't eat anything else. So it's also a very greasy diet. It's got a lot of fat in it, so it keeps the weight onto these little old cats when they're not keen to eat so much. So that's another good option. There are food supplements. Certainly, one study showed Sammy potentially helped cats with cognitive dysfunction, but it's a really complicated study that even one of the co-authors, when I asked him about it, wasn't clear about. Activate for cats. I have tried to do a study with the company about this, but they keep messing me about, which is a real shame. What they have done, though, is take out the lipoic acid. The dog version has got lipoic acid in it, and that is toxic to cats. It trashes their liver. There is no safe dose, so please don't use the dog activate for a cat. What about medications then? Well, to reduce anxiety, we've got Feelyway, and we now have two different Feelyways. We have got Feelyway Friends and Feelyway Classic. So the classic is the facial pheromone F3 from the face. So that's the one that they rub onto you when you come in, you've been outside. That reduces anxiety. And Feelyway Friends is the same as Adaptil in dogs, but for cats. So it's the mammary one. So that is good when there's conflict between cats. You've then got the Pet Remedy, which is a herbal-based product that we haven't seen any studies in yet, but I do hear some good reports on. And then Zilkeen, there certainly are some studies on this in a number of different species, including cats and people. And this it's a tryptic lysate of casein, and it actually binds to the NMDA diazepam receptors, but in a non you don't get all the side effects. So that's certainly a possibility. The antidepressants, I do not use things like fluoxetine lightly. But I do have to use them every now and again. Other things you want to consider by way of drugs, well, selegiline, and the doses note are different from those in the dog, or propantofolin, so that's vivitonin. I used to use both of those. And then I've put telmisartan at the bottom, and you're going to go, what? Why telmisartan? Well, working through the angiotensin receptor blocker, which is what it acts through, so it's an antagonist of that, or it's a blocker of that, but it is also a partial agonist of PPAR. And between both of those together, in a number of recent rat studies, have been shown to reduce nerve damage, brain damage from a lot of different routes. So it really does look like it might be a very useful drug in cats with dementia, but we don't know yet. I am doing a double-blind placebo-controlled study using telmisartan in cats with chronic kidney disease, and I will report on that as soon as I've got some results, which should be next year. So certainly I think it's a potentially very useful, particularly as, of course, as we know it's safe and effective for chronic kidney disease, which these cats often have too. So what about arthritis then? Well, if you're talking about true appendicular arthritis, so we're talking about synovial joints, then very, very common. So at least 85% of cats older than 12 have got it. And to be honest, if they're older than 12, just presume they've got arthritis, because if they haven't got true OA, and the most common places are stifles, elbows and hips, then they're going to have spondylosis deformans, where you've got all of this bony deposition below the spine. These aren't arthritic, these aren't OA joints, so it's not true OA, although if it affects the facet joints, which is there, that can be incredibly painful. Most of these studies have been done on radiographic studies where they're retrospectives, you know, so people have just gathered together, you know, all the cat chests that have been radiographed, and so they didn't have paws on. When you include paws, then you get a lot of problems with the tarsi and the carpi as well, not surprisingly. Mostly in the cat, it does appear to be idiopathic, in as much as compared to the dog, it's much more likely to be a developmental problem. You know, it's going to be a Labrador with shoulder congenital shoulder problem, or it's going to be a Springer Spaniel with elbows, etc. We don't seem to see that much that we know as true genetic problems in cats. Not that we don't see any, though. We certainly see it secondary to trauma. This is a little cat called Tripod. You can guess the other back leg has been removed, and during his car accident he's obviously blurred into this joint, and he's got crippling arthritis in his one remaining back leg. Infection we don't see so frequently, but we can see it particularly with mycoplasma and mycobacteria. Obesity we know gives a massive risk for arthritis, so we really don't want to see our cats getting too fat. And lifestyle, obviously, if you're hunting, shooting, fishing kind of cat, getting bumped by cars, etc., that's going to be more damaging than being a safe cat in a house. But then you might not be very fit if you live inside only. What I would say by way of developmental things, we see, you really don't see Burmese. This is Maya. She's got diabetes as well, of course. She's got horrible OA of her elbows. And you don't see a Burmese of the age of 8 or older that hasn't got some degree of enthesiophytosis and bony change around their elbows. But the other ones we'd particularly see would be patellar luxation, particularly in Bengals, and then hip dysplasia, which of course is most prevalent in Maine Coons and Persian cats. In fact, a recent study showed that between 25, well, two different studies, one showed 25%, one showed 50% of Bengals, Maine Coons have got hip dysplasia. This is my beautiful boy. This is his hips at a year old. When I first met him, he came to the clinic to have bilateral tibial crest transformation because his patellar luxation was so bad because his hip dysplasia was hideous. This is his hips at 4 years. I hate to think what they look like now. They're just so thickened. His elbows and his knees and his hips, they're all hideous, bony. And lumpy and thickened. So what do we expect OA to look like in a cat? Well, it's much more subtle because in most cases it is going to be symmetrical, and it comes on much more slowly. So you're not going to see really of a lameness. You're not going to see obvious joint pain. Cats going to hide that. Remember that they are prey species, so they have evolved to hide their pain. The joint swelling is not going to be soft. It is much more likely to be bony. So if you're looking for lameness as you see it in the dog, you're not going to see it in the cat. So what do you see? Oh, my little icons have gone strange. The biggest one is a reduced ability to jump. Either they're not as keen to jump up, or they're not as keen to jump as far. Instead of, whereas they would have done before, jumping straight onto the table, they now jump onto a chair to get onto the table. That sort of thing. And owners note this, but they won't tell it you unless you ask them. And obviously there's going to be significant problems using the litter box, particularly if you've got any other problems, for example, constipation. So you're really going to have to strain when you've got a lot of arthritis. Can they get into the box if you've got a litter box? Or if it's outside, can they get out of the cat flap? Getting through a cat flap is very rude. I know, because my friend Sarah Caney has a dog flap. Before my back went, I actually used to get into a house that way. And get into only part of a house, I mean, to say. But obviously I'm not fit enough to, but I can tell you, it's not the easiest thing to do when I was fit. Other things, particularly problems with the stairs, difficult to go downstairs when you've got elbow problems, difficult to go upstairs when you've got hip and stifle problems. And look at their toenails. Obviously elderly cats don't retract their toenails as well. And then they can't strop them, you know, like to pull the shells off as well, because their elbows or their shoulders hurt. And the owner of little Snowy here, elderly lady, and these are Snowy's paws, she was so upset when I showed her this, absolutely horrified. She was just beside herself. I don't understand. Why didn't he tell me? How can he have been in so much pain and he didn't tell me? But of course, he was lame on all four paws. All he could do was shuffle and move as little as possible. So we need to get our owners checking the paws of their elderly cats, because this can happen really easily. I have had numerous vets bring me pussycats with their paws grown in like that. So it really is an easy thing to miss. Using some kind of arthritis dementia questionnaire can really help. If you go to, this is my version, but there's a really nice one on Sarah Caney's website. That's catprofessional.com. Catprofessional.com. It also is vetprofessional.com. We'll get you there. And she's got a better one than me. I need to add that to this talk. So if you were to put this sort of thing in your vaccine request cards for your pussycats who are maybe from 8 or so, then owners are going to look at this and they maybe start ticking some boxes, and they're going to start going, oh, hang on, he is doing quite a lot of these things. Now, you don't want to scare them, so you also need to put in their information about all the things that can be done to help these cats, even if it's the free information, lifting up cat bowls for them to eat more comfortably, making sure you've got a very wide litter box with a low front and tall ends. You, all of that sort of thing. Free advice. Owners love free advice. And that way they'll see that you're trying to do a good thing for their cats too. So it is important to not just assume that the cat's getting old. You need to ask the questions. And I'm not saying that meloxicam is the be-all and the end-all at all. What I'm saying is this study shows that if we do something to try and intervene, you can get a marked to moderate improvement in up to 75% of these cats. So why wouldn't we? So other things we can do. Well, this is Cardu at the top. He was quite poorly, so he's getting his food in a feeding bowl, so that is going to help keep him moving and reduce his weight at the same time, which is great. Heated beds, cats and dogs with sore joints love heated beds. And then if I asked you how many of you have a cat cuddle it regularly, you'd all put your hands up. But what about massage? And this is my Mort, and I'm massaging the cramps that he gets in his back legs. And you can see he's just lying there as happy as anything, going, oh yeah, mummy, I've got my staff. Mummy's rubbing my sore legs. So easy thing to teach owners. Lots of stuff on the web about it as well. So that's a really good thing that we can suggest. More environmental things. Well, think about making the cats more comfortable. So think about their core territory might need to shrink. We talked about that with cognitive dysfunction. We talked about their key resources. Keeping them all on the same level, in as much as so they don't have to jump. But actually, with things like resting places, if you can raise them up, they actually prefer that. So it's finding the right way to make it easy for them. So here, if we look at the top, this is Blue, and her bowls have been raised very inexpensively so that she's now drinking. That's her drinking, and she's comfortably drinking now, which she wasn't before. This is my tea and Enoch. She was still alive. And initially, I just put her bowl on a plastic tub, but she was wanting to keep pushing it over, which made me jump apart from anything else. So we got her a posh thing for lifting bowls up. And this is Bailey. He's got, this is elevated as well. This means that any cats with elbow arthritis, shoulder arthritis, etc., can eat and drink without putting pressure on the front joints. They're going to eat and drink much more readily, and it's amazing how much more consumption you can see, which is great. Water, if they are cats that are used to, for example, having water in a sink, maybe they can't get up there anymore. So you need to suggest water fountains, etc. You need to find out what they like. These two cats actually like drinking out of glass mugs. Resting places we've already considered, and say keeping them warm. This is my little Bengal over here when she was still alive, and that's a fleece that was her fleece to sit on and keep her company, keep her comfy. So here we've got heated beds at the top. This is Bailey. This is Bailey cuddled with his friends and family, but he wasn't comfy enough. He needed more heat. So he sat and told his mum, "I'd like to be here, but this isn't comfy." So then she bought him a fleece. There's a happy cat. Doesn't have to be expensive. There's my little Sheba Ardbeg on just a duvet. And it really doesn't need to be expensive. It can just be a good old-fashioned cardboard box with something warm to line it. But also talk them through, where do the cats like to get to? Can they get to them comfortably? Here we've got Nimbu. This is Nimbu's favourite lookout post, but he couldn't get up there very easily. So his dad, John, made him the steps. Isn't that great? And again, lovely steps there. This was Daisy's favourite place, so her mum gave her a little ramp, although that's a pretty steep ramp. Here we've got my beautiful Mortlach. Initially, this box, which was also his toy box, was enough. But you can see we've got a pretty tall bed. So then John, who made the previous slide, he made these steps for Mortlach, which is just perfect. You can see Mort's very happy with that. And you can buy a lot of these things on the internet as well. When it comes to litter boxes, so this is what we have. It's a very wide, you can see Mortlach in there. So it's very wide, very tall at the side and the back, so you don't get all the spillage when they can't crouch down as well as they used to, but low at the front so he can get in easily. In the hospital, we just use these trays. This, look at this one a little closely. That's actually the litter box from hell, because the cat can get in but can't get back out again. And if you're collecting urine, can I suggest you use Medicat? It seems to be much more comfortable on their paws than Catcaw or the ones that are the little tiny beads. It just looks like sand. Hiding places we've already discussed, and then we've already talked about a lot of older cats really don't want to go out anymore. If they do go out, if they can have a walled garden, then that's perfect. That's what we've got here. Here we've got a brand new run built for two Bengals. And there's my boy. We've taken him outside on a lead to help him keeping safe. And Sarah Caney, I talked to you earlier about her Hobie. Playing, when they're playing, some of them do love playing. These are toys designed, I'd love to remember who gave them to me. They're actually made for cats with arthritis. They're really lightweight, so they can pick them up easily and play with them. And this is actually my little girl's scratching post. She scratches horizontally, not vertically. This is corrugated paper, but it's also got holes in the side, which Mortlach likes to put his paws into because there's a ping pong ball in there. Hunting, I really try to not encourage it. These, as you can see, elderly cats who still seem to be doing it. Thankfully, they don't seem to be quite as efficient at it as they get older. And companionship is, say, the key resource that is the one that's not there every time. What about diet studies for joints then? Well, I've already mentioned JD. It is an excellent food. What I will say though is it does have high fat levels, so be careful. They can get a little fat sometimes, which actually you want that in our elderly cats. And then there's the Royal Canin Mobility Support, which there's a this lovely study using mobility activity monitors showing that these cats really were much more active when they were fed this food, which is great. And I already mentioned the JD study. It's just there's the everything that's been done to these diets to make them so effective. But not surprising, they do make a big difference. Then what about other treatments? Well, this is case to case dependent, and there's not a lot of published treatment. Physiotherapy, I absolutely believe in, massage, etc. Hydrotherapy, I'm not sure that cat looks very comfortable. The topical laser therapy, certainly I've had that on my hands. I have Jupitrons and it has helped my hands. And some people really swear it makes some cats' mobility improve. It's certainly something to try. Ultrasound, the same. Actually, it's ultrasound. I meant not laser. I apologize. Acupuncture, this is Sam Linley. This little cat is not sedated and he was so painful beforehand and we couldn't find a pain regime to keep him comfy. So certainly something to consider. It really does seem to help some cats. And then, I don't think it'll be long before we're thinking about stem cells and things like that as more data comes through. We've got the glucosamine type products. The one that I find to be most useful is Yuumove. Interestingly, that's the one with green lip muscle. And green lip muscle in humans has been shown to be as efficient as non-steroidals for knee arthritis. So there may well be something in that, but it's unlikely to be efficient in or effective in more severe cases. NSAIDs, I'll talk about that on the next slide. By way of, oh, don't know why I've written tramadol twice, that's a bit odd. By way of opiates, we've got buprenorphine by mouth. And when I say that, you don't need to put squirt it in the mouth. You can put a little tiny smear of their favourite food on a bowl, drip the boop on top, and let them lick that off. In licking something sticky off, something like a licky licks or something like that, they get the bup all the way around the mouth. And 20 minutes later, you'll see the pupils go huge and the cat starts purring. So it certainly can work. By way of other drugs, we're using a lot more gabapentin now, and I had trouble with the standard formulation. My boy just found it was horrible, made him feel sick, and he really hated the taste. In which case, can I tell you to go to Nick Bova? So that's Nick at Bova. Actually, what I'll do is I'm going to send a link to Sammy Joe because it's a new formulation. A reformulation company that has just started up in small animals in Britain. It was doing equine for a year already. They do a gabapentin that is a liquid, tastes of chicken. My boy loves it. They've also got doxycycline monohydrates and things like that. So I'll make sure to put that link in. I've only just discovered him. Tramadol, it turns out that actually it works better in cats than dogs, but it doesn't work in all cats and doesn't even work in half dogs. So whenever you dispense a painkiller, just because you've dispensed it doesn't mean it's definitely going to work. You need to make sure the owner is aware that it might not work, in which case there are other things to try. With time, we should get, well, the Grapiprant is already available for dogs. And data is coming through for cats. I can't recommend it just yet, but it is a watch this space. And I don't even know how to say this one, Frunerbetmab. The data really looks interesting, but we're definitely not there yet. But when we do get there, it could be one injection sub-Q every 6 weeks. So fingers crossed, hey. What about meloxicam then? Well, and yes, I could have any non-steroidal. Well, no, I couldn't have any non-steroidal. I really would only use meloxicam or Onsu really for cats. And Metoclopram is my preferred because it's got the long license and because it's so cat-friendly with the liquid preparation. But I'm not saying not to use Onsu. I have used it. It's just my preference is here. The importance with whichever you use, you need to titrate down. You are not going to be using the same kind of doses that you use in healthy younger cats, all right? And in two studies, which they were looking at cats with arthritis and kidney disease, And it actually found that the cats with arthritis and kidney disease, the ones that were on Metacam, not only were better quality of life, they lived longer, but they were only on 0.02 milligrams per kilogram once daily. And it's important that if they don't eat the food, they don't get the drug. There are some surgeries. They're really salvage procedures, unless it's just removing joint mice. And the idea of joint mice in a cat amuses me. So to finish off, let's tidy up and bring us back to Sally. Elderly cats are likely to have multiple interacting diseases. You could have PUPD, which is making inappropriate urination worse. You could have hypertension, which is making dementia worse. Arthritis, which is going to make everything worse. So you really need to know exactly what's happening in this cat. Get the owners to do a lot of work for you. Monitoring the cat's weight, really important. And 5% or more change since your last consult, whether it was last week or last year, is really significant. Think about what it would be to lose 5% of your weight. You wouldn't lose that without noticing. That absolutely means you need to do further investigation. Get them to monitor food, water, pee, poo, if they can, if the cat's an indoor cat. Get them to do the questionnaire, but you do need to tailor to the individual cat. So all of these things you're going to be thinking about anyway. Really, I want to underline the taking the weight, writing it down, and calculating the percentage change. I should have body condition score there. I should also have muscle condition score there. Make a note of those. Check the eyes and the blood pressure before you consider taking bloods. Because if you raise that cat's head to take jugular bloods, or you just hold that cat snug to take cephalic bloods, that can be enough to raise the intracranial pressure such that the cat will have one monster size stroke and die. I know of a number of cats that have died. Elderly cats have died while having blood taken. I have done it myself, and I don't want you to ever have to share that hideous feeling of knowing what you just caused that was so predictable. There is nothing that you need to know about the cat's blood that can't wait the 3 days it will take for the amlodipine to get the cat's blood pressure back into normal. Definitely check pee. We could have a whole conversation about that. And obviously, our owners can bring the pee in. That really helps. So here are Sally's results. Her urea and creatinine are up a bit. And urine-specific gravity is 10.35, but remember, she's dehydrated. So actually, it's not high enough. Yes, you could say it's okay, but she normally eats half wet food, half dry food. So actually, it should be higher than this. So I think her kidneys aren't great. Liver is not perfect, but what do we think of a T4? Well, a T4 is 60. With a top normal on this reference interval of 65, you could say, well, that's okay. Really? What should the T4 of an elderly cat be that's poorly? And she's clearly poorly. Yeah, it should be low. So I think that that is too high. So I think she's probably early hypothyroid, which would explain what's happening with these liver enzymes. The glucose, she's a little bit stressed. Blood pressure, thankfully, is okay. And her pee, she does not have a UTI. That's such an important thing to look at. We did do radiographs and ultrasound. We did an echo. She has got some degree of cardiac hypertrophy, probably secondary. And we checked for a meningioma. Thankfully, she didn't have one. She has got some brain atrophy. So what's my diagnosis? How are we going to interpret these? Well, kidneys, yeah, I think marginal renal insufficiency. Let's keep a look on that. I think we've got early hypothyroidism, and I think what I would add there is maybe we should do we should be checking this more frequently. I think the cardiac has changed. Yeah, I think we all agree with those. So, how are we going to manage this little cat? Her cognitive dysfunction. Well, environmental modification is the first place to go. Let's get all her key resources where she can reach them, and she might well need to shrink from the vet, and she's going to need an indoor litter box. By way of diet, either JD or mobility support would be very good places to start. And I would start with those alone and then reassess. Yes, she might need supplementation. Let's see what the drugs, what drugs are ultimately shown to work, and I've given you some options of what might be considered. Her arthritis, well, it's the same environmental modification, which I love. You're doing the same thing for the cat. It's why this talk, I think, works so well, because yes, she's got a number of problems, but actually what you actually need to advise the owners to do is more limited. So we want to make sure we've got all the resources that she needs so she can get to them. Maybe a little massage around her back end would be nice. I think her back could really do with a little bit of massage. And diet, great, let's go with JD or mobility support. If we needed supplements, remember U-Move would be my first preference. There's no surgical option for her. With time, you might need to consider non-steroidals. But you're going to keep a watch, aren't you? And by way of things to monitor, well, we know she's an elderly girl. We know that her heart is showing changes, her kidneys are showing changes, her thyroid is showing changes. So we need to assess all of those reasonably regularly. Maybe every 3 to 4 times a year is what I would be looking at with her. Yes, it does depend how bonded her owners are with her and with you, and whether they're insured or not. I know that's going to make a big difference. What I would point out is, remember, she's got a lot of arthritis, as do so many of our old cats. And there's quite a lot of hands in here, but this cat is just stood in a comfortable position for having her bloods. And remember, you're not going to be taking bloods until you've checked their eyes or their blood pressure. I know that's going to be a nuisance for you, but really, it is my recommendation. It's now the recommendation of all of us feline gerontology people. So I hope that was useful for you. This is Sarah Caney's website that I mentioned. This is a lovely little book that she's written along with Vicky Halls, who I think is the best cat behaviorist there is, and it's Caring for the Elderly Cat. It's aimed at owners, but for vets, for nurses, etc. Very, very readable and accessible. So I hope there's been some useful stuff in there, and I'm very happy to take some questions. If I can get my pages back. There we go. There we go. Okay. Okay, in which case, if you're being shy, what I think is really worth talking a little bit more to you about is the use of non-steroidals, or particularly analgesia, in elderly cats, because people are very, very scared of it, and yet it's such an important thing. And because I've got, my cats live forever, and then I inherit elderly cats, so I seem to only ever have old souls. And I just wanted to go back over that study, that the two studies, they were in Australia, and they were in general practice. And they gathered up all the cases of cats that had chronic kidney disease and osteoarthritis. And then they looked at all of those that were on Metacam and those that weren't. And they got the owners to assess quality of life, but also they monitored them with time. And the cats that, as I mentioned, had the best quality of life, which is as you'd expect because they were analgesed, were those on the meloxicam. But it was when it was to how long they lived, and that they lived longer, was like, oh, why was that? But then think about it. What is the pathology in chronic kidney disease? It's interstitial nephritis. It's got an itis on the end. It's an inflammatory condition. So it's not surprising that a low-dose non-steroidal might well help these guys. Now, it's a case of titration. It's very important that the owners are completely on board with this. They need to understand that if the cat, say, doesn't eat, they don't get their medication. And if you explain it to them the same way as they would take painkillers, that some days, you know, it's sunny and warm, you feel fine, and you really don't need as high dose, or you don't need any. Whereas other days, maybe it's really cold and miserable, it's been raining, and you're going to feel much more uncomfortable. So they need to monitor the movement and comfort of their cat so they can increase the dose when it's needed and reduce it when it isn't. So it really does mean we've got to be really working. It's got to be a really good communication with our owners of elderly cats. And whatever painkiller we give them, and often we need multiple painkillers. Say my boy is on meloxicam and gabapentin. You don't know one of the, know what my list is. I'm on five different painkillers. So, and that is how you get less side effects with better analgesia. Multimodal analgesia is definitely the best way to control pain. But the downside is we don't have as many drugs that are useful with cats, and they've got to be cat friendly, which is why I was so pleased to find that Nick Bova has started doing this chicken flavored gabapentin. And so he sent me a sample. He was at VetFest, and so he sent me a sample after I chatted with him, and I thought, this looks so dodgy, getting a sample of drugs in the post, and just immediately gave some to Mortlach, my boy, and he doesn't even notice. And what was lovely, he ran around like a mad idiot the other day, well, hobbled around, but he was just so happy that he could do it. So please consider mixed analgesia. Consider low doses. So when you're using meloxicam, it's 0.02 mg per kg, and that's you start on that dose and then move up if you need to. I actually start low now. Yes, you could start on a standard dose, just a standard dose, not the loading dose that you'd give after surgery. So you could start on 0.05 mg per kg and wean down, but actually my preference is to start low. I think that works very well. So there is so much we can do to help these cats. I love working with geriatrics, but we really, really have to work with the clients. It means consults are longer, so you might want to consider if you've got a nurse, or if I've got nurses listening, that is wanting to start geriatric clinics. The nurses can do a lot because they can talk to the owners beforehand about, for example, ways of making it easier to get the cat into the cat carrier to get it to the clinic. So, for example, you can use gabapentin. You could send gabapentin, if you've seen them reasonably recently, then they could, you could send out some gabapentin to them for them to give the cat, so that if it's very stressed for the journey, that actually takes the edge off the journey. That works very well, as does trazodone. I ignore my second one. It's not quite at the tip of my brain, so if I haven't got spelling right, I'm not going to say it. But certainly, we're using gabapentin to make it easier for people to bring cats into the clinic, because I mentioned the two major reasons why people don't bring elderly cats in that they are worried we won't be able to help, and that we're going to suggest that the cat should be euthanized. But the other, I think, equally important one is they feel that it is so stressful for the cat and for them. If you then add on the fact they think we won't be able to help and that we'll put them to sleep, you can see why we've got work to do. So if you've got nurses really engaging, you've got someone who really loves working with the geriatrics, putting a little newsletter in for the cases that are older than 8 when you're sending out vaccine cards, saying to contact us about ways to make it easier to bring your cat to the clinic. And then you see the nurses can see them first, they can weigh them, see what the weight change is. If the weight is stable, then it becomes less important to take bloods, etc. You could send out the Medicat in the post. It is a little bit on the heavier side, but cats do prefer it. And one study that Sarah Caney did, I think it was something, it was cats older than 12, I think. It's not on the tip of my brain, but it was something like cats older than 12, and something like a third of the cats had changes on their urine that suggested you needed further investigation. And she said they more than made their money back. And I know a number of practices that do that. They routinely send out the urine packs and say they will do dipstick in a specific gravity sediment for free. And then whatever they find, it's they know it's a money making thing to do. So really, developing geriatric clinics can be so rewarding. So the weights checks are done, the urine's done, blood pressure has been done, etc., before they ever need to have bloods. And if all of those are normal, you can argue, okay, let's hold off on the bloods. Maybe do that when we see the cat in the next, 4 months down the line. And the owners will be very receptive of that. And what's good is the insurance companies are quite comfortable with that approach as well. So are there any questions for me? If not, it just reminds me, let me see if there were any. think we're okay. In which case, if you haven't got any questions, I hope that means that the lecture was useful and I didn't say anything stupid. Please feel free to share all information that I talk about. And so I do strongly take you towards catprofessional.com and the Bova Labs. It's Bova. If you put in Nick, Nick, Bova, and I think off the top of my head, it's Nick at bova.com is his email. So I think then I shall just thank Sammy Joe Howard, as always, for organising a fabulous webinar for us. And best of luck and have a good day. Good night. Good day.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Danielle for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.